Welcome to the Hannah Miller Show. And here she is, Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly Christian, this is Hannah Miller. And today's episode is actually going to be a conversation between my dad and myself regarding some legislation that is being dealt with here in the state of South Carolina. Now, if you are outside of South Carolina and listening to the Hannah Miller Show, this still pertains to you because the conversation is about medical marijuana. And no matter where your state is, as far as legalizing medical marijuana or marijuana just across the board legalization, this will be an interesting conversation because we're going to be bringing up a lot of relevant information. And as a matter of fact, if you're a parent or a grandparent, you want to hear what we have to say because a lot of it, we're going to be talking about enforcement. We're going to be talking about side effects. We're going to be long and short term side effects. We're going to be talking about how it's impacting youth and just a lot of things, mental illnesses that are associated with marijuana usage that nobody's talking about, some alternatives to marijuana, one primary alternative to marijuana that folks really need to know about as well. So it's a fascinating conversation. So I invite you to take part in this, whether you are outside of the state or of South Carolina or not, because it's very relevant information no matter where your state is regarding marijuana and the legalization of marijuana. So I invite you in to join with us with this conversation with my dad, Dr. Robert Jackson, who's the host of More Than Medicine, and myself. So the very first thing that we want to cover is what is medical marijuana?
Well, it's a difficult discussion because there are a lot of misconceptions about what exactly is medical marijuana and what that term refers to. And when people say medical marijuana, they're referring to the whole unprocessed marijuana plant or its basic extracts in order to treat a disease or disease symptoms. The FDA has not recognized or approved the marijuana plant as a medicinal. Now, scientific study of the chemicals in marijuana, which are called cannabinoids, has led to two FDA-approved medications that contain cannabinoid chemicals in a pill form. Continued research may lead to more medications down the road. Because the marijuana plant contains chemicals that may help treat a range of illnesses or symptoms, many people argue that it should be legal for medical purposes. In fact, a growing number of states have legalized marijuana for medical use only.
So the history of marijuana as a Schedule I drug, let's talk about that for a little bit. This is in 1970, the U.S. Congress placed marijuana in Schedule I of the Controlled Substances Act because they considered it to have, quote, no accepted medical use, end quote. Since then, though, at least 37 of the 50 U.S. states and D.C. have legalized the medical use of marijuana, and I think that number is even higher now than when I originally did this research.
Contradistinction to the FDA.
Yes.
So you have states that are saying, yes, it's okay in our state, when the federal government has said, no, it's not okay.
Which, you know, we're people who, over the last 2 years, if you've listened to either one of our shows, know that we do question the FDA, and we don't necessarily just toe the line with everything that comes from the FDA. But you'll see as we kind of progress into this what that means for medical marijuana and for the medicinal usages of marijuana. So there is a reasoning behind the FDA approving it, and we're going to get into that. But if you've listened to us, you know that we don't automatically just assume, okay, it has to have the FDA stamp of approval, and if it doesn't, it's all trash and it can't be used for that, because we ourselves have often questioned things that have FDA approval or things that don't have FDA approval. And we want to do our own research and think this through. And so that's what we're doing today.
That's right.
So you know, talking about that at Schedule One drugs, these substances, it means it has a high potential for abuse. No currently accepted medical use and treatment in the U.S. and a lack of accepted safety for use under medical provision. So that's what it means to be a Schedule One substance.
So what are some of the Schedule One substances?
Some of those are methamphetamine, LSD, and heroin.
And you mean marijuana is listed in that group with those drugs?
Yes, marijuana and among the top 20 drugs. Ranked by overall harm, marijuana is number 8. Alcohol is number 1, followed by heroin, crack cocaine, meth as number 4, cocaine as 5, tobacco is 6, and amphetamine is number 7.
And marijuana comes number 8. Now, interestingly, if you look at that list, 3 of the drugs in that list are legal. 2 of them can be purchased over the counter. Alcohol, the number 1 drug causing the most harm is alcohol, and anybody over 21 can go purchase that.
Mm-hmm.
Number 6 on the list is tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody over 21 can go purchase tobacco. And it's number 6 on the list of most harmful drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Amphetamine requires a prescription, but it's listed as number 7 on the top 20 most harmful drugs. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. And then, of course, marijuana is listed number 8.
So, Dad, tell us, what are their proponents saying who support medical marijuana?
All right. Folks who are in support of medical marijuana argue that it can be a safe and effective treatment for symptoms of cancer, primarily nausea, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, some types of pain, glaucoma, epilepsy, and other conditions. And in fact, there is a medication derived from marijuana that effectively treats childhood epilepsy. There's a product that treats weight loss caused by cancer and AIDS. So there is some legitimacy to that claim. They cite dozens of peer-reviewed studies, prominent medical organizations, major government reports, and the use of marijuana as medicine throughout world history in support of their claims. But then there are opponents who cite the exact same things.
Right.
Opponents of medical marijuana argue that it's too dangerous to use and that it lacks FDA approval and thus cannot be prescribed by a doctor.
And that's one of the aspects of FDA approval that's important for this discussion and why, even though we don't always toe the line when it comes to the FDA, especially when it comes to things like ivermectin and, you know, the COVID vaccines and things like that.
That's right.
The important aspect about this is that it cannot be prescribed by your doctor because it's not FDA approved. And we'll get more into that later on.
Yeah. And various legal drugs make marijuana use unnecessary. There are plenty of drugs for treating epilepsy and weight loss and nausea and all those kinds of things. But these folks also cite peer-reviewed studies, prominent medical organizations, and major government reports that describe marijuana as addictive, a drug that leads to harder drug use, as interfering with fertility, impairing driving ability, and as injuring the lungs, immune system, and the brain. They say that medical marijuana is a front for drug legalization and recreational use. Now, as a physician, I know for a fact that marijuana is many times more harmful on the lungs than cigarette smoking.
Mm.
I also know that marijuana impairs driving ability. It interferes with fertility. So these claims are very, very true.
One of the numbers you were telling me earlier was from Colorado, right? About,
yeah.
You know, they legalized marijuana and what's been the impact on driving and driving fatalities because of medical marijuana?
Marijuana was legalized in 2014 in the state of Colorado. And the law enforcement officers and departments in Colorado have been tracking fatalities associated with marijuana use has gone up 22% in their state, and it went up dramatically immediately in the year after marijuana was legalized in that state.
And then I heard, too, reading about the same topic, the fact that they say it's much more expensive to treat to test somebody for medical marijuana than it is for alcohol. Mm-hmm. And they say typically those two things go hand in hand. And so when there's a fatality or when somebody gets pulled over for your DUI, the first thing they test them for is alcohol, even if they suspect there's marijuana involved as well. And if there's alcohol, they don't go any further.
So it's underreported, is what happens.
Yes. And so what you're looking at is probably a very, very underreported.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about short-term versus long-term effects of marijuana. So what, in your research, Ms. Hannah, talk to us a little bit about short-term effects.
So some of the short-term effects, when a person smokes marijuana, THC, and we're going to talk about THC later, but THC quickly passes from the lungs into the bloodstream. And the blood carries the chemical to the brain and other organs throughout the body. The body absorbs THC more slowly when the person eats or drinks it rather than smoking it. And in that case, the users generally feel the effects after about 30 minutes to 1 hour. THC acts on specific brain cell receptors that ordinarily react to natural THC-like chemicals in the brain. These natural chemicals play a role in normal brain development and function. So marijuana overactivates parts of the brain that contain the highest number of these receptors. This causes, quote, the high that users feel. So then other side effects, short-term side effects, include altered senses, for example, seeing brighter colors, altered sense of time, changes in mood, impaired body movement, which is why they don't like you to operate heavy machinery, drive your car while you're under the influence of marijuana, difficulty with thinking and problem solving. This is also why they don't like for children and students to be taking it, to be driving, because you're problem solving when you drive, you're problem solving when you're working, you're also problem solving when you're a parent. And so they don't like, it's unsafe for those situations. And then lastly, impaired memory.
All right. But then there are also long-term effects. Mm-hmm. Marijuana affects brain development. When marijuana users begin using as teenagers, the drug reduces thinking, memory, and learning functions, and affects how the brain builds connectivity between the areas necessary for these functions. Marijuana effects on these abilities may last a long time or can be permanent. For example, one study showed that people who started smoking marijuana heavily in their teens and had ongoing cannabis use lost an average of 8 IQ points between ages 13 and 38. The lost mental abilities did not fully return in those who quit marijuana as adults. Those who started smoking marijuana as adults did not show notable IQ declines. So this is important for parents to understand and to teach their teenagers that if they start smoking marijuana as teenagers and continue smoking for years, that it affects their IQ and that that effect can be permanent.
So another thing for long-term effects, the National Academy of Sciences, which is the most highly regarded group of scientists in the United States, released a report in 2017 based on an exhaustive review of all known research on marijuana. And their unequivocal conclusion is that cannabis use increases risk of developing schizophrenia and other psychoses. And Sheriff B. Moore, who's an epidemiologist with Drug Free America Foundation, where he collects, analyzes, and interprets epidemiological data on substance abuse trends, and all of this in order to inform program planning and policy at the local, state, and federal levels, he also performed an extensive search of the literature from the time the NAS report was released through February 2019. So 2017 to 2019, and found that nearly every study on this topic, without exception, found an association between marijuana and schizophrenia and other psychoses.
Well, that's interesting because, as you know, I worked at the behavioral health ward, quote, psych ward, at our local hospital for 14 years. And patients who came in the hospital with schizophrenia flare-ups almost always were smoking marijuana.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
The association between marijuana and schizophrenia is well known to those who work on the behavioral health ward at the hospital. And, you know, that particular drug often triggers a flare-up of schizophrenia. And that connection is well known.
So talk to us a little bit about in biomedical research and when you're evaluating a potential causal relationship between an exposure and disease, for example, marijuana use and mental illness. Talk to us about the set of criteria that has to be met or applied.
All right. In biomedical research, when evaluating a potential causal relationship between an exposure and a disease, for example, marijuana use and mental illness, a set of criteria known as the A-B Hill criteria are applied. Temporality, strength of association, dose response, consistency, biological plausibility, consideration of alternative hypotheses, experiment, specificity, and coherence. All of these are the criteria. Mm-hmm. Now, to put it briefly, if an association satisfies a majority of these criteria, it may be considered causal. On a whole, the evidence Alex Berenson lays out in his book, Tell Your Children, which is a book about marijuana and its effects on children, based on 50 years of peer-reviewed research, satisfies at least 7 of the 9 A.B. Hill criteria. Now, to put that into perspective, the association between cigarette smoking and lung cancer satisfies 8 out of the 9 criteria.
And we all just know that that's true. 8 out of the 9, and we all know that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer. And so right next to that, 7 out of the 9.
7 out of the 9 connects marijuana with schizophrenia.
And nobody knows about this.
Nobody talks about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's just one of those taboo subjects.
I mean, when I was doing the research on this, I was what? And there's a lot of evidence that backs this up. This is not just something.
Listen, and schizophrenia is one of those things that's on the rise in our culture.
And everybody's wondering why.
And people are wondering why. And nobody wants to admit that marijuana is the thing that's triggering that increase in schizophrenia in our culture today.
And you're even seeing it, as you said, in the psych ward when you worked there.
That's right.
For 14 years.
And almost every time, and I can't say 100%, but lots and lots of times when folks came in with that flare-up of schizophrenia or that first-time diagnosis, you look into their history, and these folks are heavy users of marijuana.
Right. So let's talk about professionals in the field of medical marijuana. And the very first group that I want to talk about is physicians, because I want to get your perspective as a physician. And you've kind of sprinkled it already this. But what are some of the other physicians talking about when it comes to medical marijuana?
All right. Well, here's a study that was conducted by a doctor named Ellen Kondrad, K-O-N-D-R-A-D. He was medical director for the Family Medicine Center at the St. Anthony Family Medicine Residency, and he had a few other folks who were in cahoots with him on this study. And what they did was they surveyed family physicians' attitudes towards medical marijuana in the state of Colorado, and they reported this in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine. And their finding was that nearly all of the family physicians in Colorado, they agreed on the need for further medical education about medical marijuana, and they surveyed 1,727 members of the Colorado Academy of Family Physicians. 520, which is 30% of those surveyed, responded to their survey, and only 30% of the respondents ever recommended medical marijuana to a patient. So of those family doctors in Colorado who were willing to respond, only 30% of them had ever recommended marijuana, even though it was legal in Colorado. Of the responding physicians, 46% said that physicians should not recommend marijuana as a medical therapy at all. Most of the physicians surveyed agreed that there were significant physical and mental health risk with marijuana use. Only a minority of physicians surveyed disagreed that there was significant physical and mental health risk with marijuana use. When asked about the benefits of marijuana use, 27% of those surveyed agreed that there were significant physical health benefits. So only 27% felt like marijuana was beneficial, whereas 61% and 64% felt there was significant physical and mental health risk. So in general, the physicians in Colorado, where marijuana is legal, were in the majority opposed to prescribing it and felt like it was a dangerous product. Now, what about law enforcement, Hannah?
So in my research on this, I've talked to multiple sheriffs, multiple state patrol officers, a lot of different police officers and law enforcement officers across the board of different kinds, and almost all law enforcement officers are unequivocally opposed to the legalization of marijuana. And most are opposed to the legalization of medical marijuana, to take that a step further, because they all know what medical marijuana leads to. And they all know that when we say medical marijuana and it's not been FDA approved, that means you're trotting down to the dispensary down the street and you're getting, you know, marijuana that you have no idea how high the THC is, which is the part of marijuana that gives you the high. You don't know what the quality is. So it's just a lot. Anyway, they know what it means. And so the vast majority, pretty much all of them, really. And according to a Tennessee sheriff that I talked to, at least 50% of his arrests involving marijuana also involve other drugs and alcohol. And that's the thing that everybody thinks, you know, you just use marijuana and people only use marijuana. And he said, no, I mean, every time I have, 50% of the times where I'm pulling over somebody and I find marijuana, I'm also finding, you know, cocaine or heroin or all these other things as well, and drugs. And then in Colorado, fatalities due to marijuana doubled the year after marijuana was legalized. And so, and we alluded to a little bit about fatalities regarding traffic accidents, I believe. So.
Well, you know, as a family physician, one of my responsibilities is to do random drug screens on patients who obtained narcotic pain relievers as a prescription. And there's a significant percentage of my patients who have chronic pain issues, who have a legitimate need for narcotic pain relievers. And it's my responsibility to do random drug screens on those patients. And it's always a surprise to me when those patients show up with other substances on their drug screens. And, you know, they show up with amphetamines, they show up with marijuana, they show up with cocaine. And these folks know that I'm going to do random drug screens, but their lives are so out of control and they're so addicted to these other substances that they cannot help themselves. Now, if I were to dismiss from my medical practice everyone who was addicted to marijuana, then probably 20% of my medical practice would be dismissed right out of hand, because marijuana use is so prevalent in certain parts of my medical practice. And so that just gives my listeners an understanding of how prevalent marijuana use is in the upstate of South Carolina. And so anyway, it's just a big, big issue. And people just need to understand that it is. And that's why, you know, law enforcement is so opposed to it, because those things travel together. Marijuana use, cocaine use, alcohol abuse, amphetamine abuse. It's not unusual for me to do a random drug screen, and all four of those will show up at the same time in the same patient.
Right. Well, let's talk about the last group of professionals that I want to have to do with this, and that's drug rehab counselors, shelter administrators, and recovering drug addicts. Most people don't go to these people and ask them, you know, what are your thoughts about medical marijuana? And I did. Yep. And I went to him and I talked to him. So
what did they tell you?
Well, the drug rehab counselors and shelter administrators that I talked to said marijuana is almost always the first drug a drug addict uses. This was also confirmed by recovering drug addicts that I talked to. Marijuana may not have an addictive high, quote, but it does have addictive qualities similar to alcohol, providing escape for its users. Because, see, that's what alcohol is all about. Alcohol is, it doesn't necessarily have a psychosis effect. It provides a high, it provides an escape. And marijuana does the same thing, and that's what's appealing about it. And all three within the category that we've covered, and all three within here, and law enforcement officers consider marijuana, and I know this is a dirty word, a gateway drug. But despite all the proponents of it, they have such a strong opposition to this term. Each considers marijuana a gateway drug because it is most often the first step into the drug usage lifestyle, thereby introducing and beginning a lifestyle of drug addiction. And this was confirmed by multiple former drug addicts that I spoke with, because I asked them, you know, explicitly, did you... was marijuana, and almost every single one of them, marijuana was the first one I used. And they all agreed that it was a gateway drug into a drug abuse lifestyle. Not necessarily a gateway drug in the way that it made me crave more and more and stronger, which is what we think of when we use that term. But it introduced them to that lifestyle and sucked them into it. And
well, it makes them, they connect with other people who use drugs.
That's what it does. And that's really what a lot of them alluded to, was that it opened that door, and that's then they connected with people in their community who they don't just sell marijuana. They're selling all of it.
They're selling everything.
And the next time they say, well, you like that feeling? I got something that, you know, is a little bit better than that.
That's exactly right.
So, and
that's what happened with my brother. My brother started off using marijuana, quickly moved to cocaine and then LSD. And for 12 years, he was addicted to the hard drugs.
Well, we've talked a little bit about young people, but nearly three quarters, about 74% of youth between the ages of 10 to 17 years old in treatment for substance abuse report marijuana as their primary substance abuse.
Hi, this is Bob of Bob Sloan Audio Productions. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Have you ever thought about doing a podcast yourself? Do you have a desire to communicate an idea, opinion, or even a hobby or interest you'd like to share with the world? And do you have the communication skill and dedication? If so, let's talk. Send an email and a short description of your idea to bob@bobsloan.com. That's bob@bobsloan.com. Now let's get back to the podcast.
And we're now moving on to the enforcement of marijuana, medical or otherwise, in the United States, because proponents of medical marijuana say that it costs so much to enforce marijuana prohibition, and a high number of good kids are making one mistake but are getting stuck with arrest records, which causes a cycle of criminal activity because they can't get jobs. So let's pick it up right there. And what are, in response to, how much is it costing? I guess that's a better way of saying it, Dad. How much is it costing taxpayers to enforce marijuana prohibition?
All right. Enforcing marijuana prohibition costs taxpayers an estimated $10 billion annually. And it results in the arrest of more than 693,000 individuals every year in the United States, which is far more than the total number of arrestees for all violent crimes combined, including murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated arrest. Now, opponents of all of this say that most states have leniency on first offense, which is true. You know, kids, teenagers who get arrested for marijuana possession, the first time they get arrested, they have all kind of pretrial intervention programs like we do in South Carolina for a first offense. which wipes their record clean after 6 to 12 months without any further offense remaining on their record. So there's all kinds of programs that allow them to work it off or to get that expunged from their record. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's different ways of looking at it.
Right. And there's other things that, you know, when you say it costs $10 billion to enforce medical marijuana or to enforce marijuana prohibition, there's a lot of other things that here in the United States that we could do to cut that and to cut back on the arrests, to cut back on how much it costs without just saying, well, it costs too much. Throw up our hands, legalize
just
it.
Legalize.
Let's just go that route. Let's think about it for a little bit. Let's pump the brakes. Let's say, okay, maybe there's probably some other things that we could do.
It costs a lot to enforce the laws against cocaine and heroin.
Yes, exactly.
And but we're not going to throw up our hands on that.
Right, and we're going to say, you know, I won't dive in further. But I know let's talk about how to qualify as a medical marijuana patient, though. How does one qualify? I know there's, I think it's 13 categories that somebody can, you know, check off.
Yeah.
In states that
in the states that have medical marijuana laws that approves the use of medical mm-hmm. marijuana, there are conditions such as HIV, anxiety, arthritis, cancer, chemotherapy side effects, eating disorders, fibromyalgia, glaucoma, Lyme disease, migraine headaches, multiple sclerosis, radiation therapy side effects, and then a variety of other chronic, debilitating, or terminal illnesses. Any of those 13 will qualify a person for medical marijuana usage in states that allow that. Now, interestingly, in the state of Colorado, where medical marijuana is allowed, the three conditions at the top, the most common conditions reported for using medical marijuana, were severe pain, muscle spasms, and severe nausea. Now pay attention. 90% of the folks that got medical marijuana in the state of Colorado received it for severe pain.
So you're telling me it's not little kids with epilepsy.
Nope.
It's not the cancer patients with nausea.
Nope.
Which are the two most often cases
cited.
Yes,
they're cited the most often. It's people with severe pain,
mm-hmm.
and that's legit. But it doesn't tug at people's emotions like little kids with epilepsy.
Well,
does.
And part of it's because we have a lot of medications out there
that
to help
can treat pain.
Yes,
that's right. Pain. Treating pain is not that difficult. There are a lot of options for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you cite that, you're not going to get medical marijuana pushed through.
Right. If they tell you that the reality is the vast majority of people just want pain help with their pain management.
That's right.
Everybody goes, well, wait a minute.
That's right.
Yes, it's a legitimate thing. And there are complicated cases for pain management, but it's not as compelling.
And of course, folks who use marijuana for treating their pain, they also get the psychoactive side mm-hmm. effects. And a lot of them, that's what they're really after as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be admitted.
So there's some who have the argument that we need to legalize medical marijuana because Big Pharma is only prohibiting it so they can make money off of synthetic medicines. And since marijuana is natural, and I'm putting quotations around that, it's cheaper and won't make pharmaceuticals as much money. Now, you and I mean, after the whole last 2 years,
we
all understand that Big Pharma's out to make money.
They're making big money.
They're out to make big money. They don't care so much about your health and you getting healthy and you staying healthy.
They just want to do a wallet biopsy on everybody they can.
That's right. And we know that. Let's talk about it, though, because
right.
Is it cheaper?
No. In Colorado, these are very interesting numbers that my sweet daughter Hannah has unearthed with her research. She's a great research assistant and beautiful on top of that, and highly intelligent. All right. A grower in Colorado can sell 1 pound of marijuana for $600 to a distributor. That distributor then turns around and sells it for $915, which includes a 15% tax. Then the retailer sells that same pound of marijuana for a 175% increase, which costs the customer $3,000. Now, it started off with a $600 1 pound amount of marijuana, which has then grossed $3,000.
And all of this is probably a little higher now due to inflation.
Sure,
a lot higher now. But yeah, we're just working off these numbers, though. This gives you an idea.
Now, let's just look at an average prescription, which is between 1 to 3 grams per day, which can either be smoked or vaporized. This is 0.5 ounces a week. This means to fill a prescription every 2 weeks, it will cost the patient $200 if they buy the cheapest grade of marijuana. Compare that to $3,000 for that retailer selling a pound. Now, I don't know how long a pound of marijuana is going to last somebody. I really don't know the answer to that question.
Well, you know, it looks like it's your an average a week for the average prescription is a half an ounce. So you got to do the math on all of that.
Yeah, you got to compare it.
And so, but that looks like it's, you know, every 2 weeks it's going to cost you $200 if you buy the cheapest, the cheapest marijuana.
Yep. So growing your own marijuana, it's meticulous. It's complicated. It requires several thousand dollars in initial startup costs, and then several hundred dollars per subsequent harvest, which takes about 90 days for every subsequent harvest.
Which is, you know, a lot of folks think that they can just go, okay, legalize it, I'm going to be able to go out and grow it myself. But come to find out, it's very meticulous. It's not just, you can't just go buy a $5 plant and then start growing it.
Yeah.
Not exactly how it works.
That's not how it works. And you got to have a little bit of a green thumb.
Yes.
To grow marijuana.
And we'll get into the details of that a little bit later too. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, so a lot of people who don't want to line the pockets of Big Pharma,
which we don't blame them,
are in the same category as those who don't want to line the pockets of government,
which we also don't want to blame them.
Well, total revenue from taxes, licenses, and fees increased from $67 million in 2014 to $387 million in 2020. Was that just in the state of Colorado?
Yeah.
Okay, that's just one state. The amount of taxes transferred to the School Capital Construction Fund and Public School Fund increased 264% from $33 million in 2015 to $120 million in 2020. Now we begin to see why politicians are increasingly in support of marijuana. It produces big money from taxes.
Mm-hmm. And so this whole argument of we need to legalize it because we hate Big Pharma, well, you're going to end up just lying. It's still big money for politicians.
Politicians and taxes. That's exactly right.
That's right.
All right. So what's our next consideration, Ms. Hannah?
Why hasn't the FDA approved marijuana for medicinal use already? What's taking them so long?
Well, here's the answer to that. Studies that involve marijuana require a license from the DEA as well as a legal marijuana source. Now, this is a sticky wicket. We all need to pay close attention. Prior to 2016, the only legal domestic source for marijuana was the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse. However, NIDA was unwilling to provide marijuana to studies which it was not also funding. The DEA also refused to grant licenses to allow legal marijuana imports for medical research. The same officials who cited insufficient research to meet the FDA standards for drug approval played a role in making sure that the research did not take place. So folks wanting to do the research couldn't get the marijuana which to do the research.
That's right.
Recently, some studies have been allowed, but not enough to allow the FDA to process or proceed at a reasonable pace. Well, on August 12, 2016, the DEA announced a new policy regarding cultivating marijuana for medical research. The DEA will no longer require all research marijuana to be grown and distributed via NIDA.
This was groundbreaking.
Oh, yes.
And
it would allow marijuana growers outside of that monopoly to apply for a registration with the DEA if they agree to only distribute marijuana with the prior written approval from the DEA. That change should result in easier access for researchers. However, DEA did not grant preliminary approval for private production of cannabis until almost 5 years later, in May 2021. So, as of May 21, all research conducted in the U.S. on botanical cannabis relied on federal cannabis, which has involved lengthy delays and lower quality cannabis. But since May of 21, there should be an explosion of research involving cannabis.
All right. Now, let's talk about a portion of this that I've really wanted to get to. And that is hemp versus marijuana. Because let me just tell you guys, this is really the crux of the matter, in my opinion. This is where our eyes begin to be opened a little bit, or a lot, and we begin to see that maybe marijuana, maybe there's an alternative, I guess. And I don't want to give too much away.
Our eyes open or our eyes get crossed?
I guess maybe a little bit of both. Because we're going to get into a little bit talking. You hear the words, and we've used them interchangeably in this podcast, talking about cannabis, talking about cannabinoids, talking about CBD, talking about THC. Well, let's flesh all of that out a little bit here. And when you start doing the research on those things, you inevitably are led to research on hemp as well. So let's talk about these two things, hemp versus marijuana. And that brings us to the 2018 Farm Bill. It legalized the growing and harvesting of hemp in the U.S. Now, hemp harvesters must follow state and tribal regulations, so that made this bill, it was punted back to the state. So it's now a state issue rather than federal, which I'm all for local. I appreciate that. I say, you bring it. Let's let the states deal with this. And, you know, then the hemp harvesters will fall under the states. Well, until recently, hemp was bred almost entirely for industrial uses like manufacturing. Hemp plants have very low amounts of THC, which is the psychoactive chemical responsible for marijuana's high. Instead, hemp plants are naturally higher in CBD, which is also found in marijuana. The exact opposite is true for marijuana. Marijuana strains now contain more THC than they did 50 years ago, which is why a lot of people say, you know, the marijuana of today is not your grandma, you know, your grandma and your grandpa's marijuana.
That's exactly right. It's not.
No, on average, a marijuana strain contains anywhere from 5 to 20% THC. And I know there's a lot of abbreviations here, but just hang with me. Some premium marijuana varieties can reach up to 30% THC. And remember, that's the chemical that's responsible for the high that you can receive. And their marijuana also tends to have very low CBD levels, somewhere between 0.1 and 2%. All right? So you got that. Very high THC, very, very low CBD. When it comes to hemp, this ratio is turned upside down. Hemp plants have a maximum THC level of 0.3%, which makes it impossible to feel any kind of psychoactive effect, let alone get high. On the other hand, their CBD levels can vary between 18 to 27%. Do you hear what I'm saying? Marijuana, CBD levels, 0.1 to 2%. The most they can give you is a 2% of CBD levels. And then hemp is between 18 to 27%. I didn't do the math on that, but that's a lot. A lot higher. And the medical benefits, all right, so let's talk about medical benefits. Medical benefits of CBD, which is what everybody talks about. They say we need marijuana because we need the CBD. Nobody ever talks about the THC because they realize that has negative connotations, and so they try to ignore that it exists in marijuana. And so CBD is what we're focusing on here. The medical benefits of CBD found in marijuana are also found in the hemp plant, which has far more uses, approximately 25,000 more uses. And it contains only, like I said, less than 0.3%. And that's compared to the 5 to 35% of THC that's found in marijuana. And more clinical trials link CBD to positive results from pain than THC. So that backs up, that's why CBD is what is benefiting people when it comes to pain, when it comes to a lot of the other, the only medical benefit marijuana has over hemp is that it appears to be slightly more effective with muscle spasm-related pain. So the only, all of those medical ailments that you went through earlier, Dad, I think it was like 13 or 14 of them, seizures, multiple sclerosis, nausea related to cancer or radiation treatments, all of those things, hemp, the CBD from hemp, treats better than marijuana, all of those, except for pain related to muscle spasms, where marijuana seems to have a little bit of an edge over hemp. And then, all right, continuing about hemp versus marijuana. The environment in which hemp and marijuana are cultivated is very different. Hemp plants can be grown tightly together. They are generally grown on large multi-acre fields. They're resistant to different climates and harsh conditions. So it's way more versatile than marijuana. Its growth cycle oscillates between around 108 to 120 days. Contrary to hemp, marijuana is much more demanding when it comes to cultivation. Marijuana plants require a carefully controlled environment in which warmth, humidity, and airflow must be maintained on the top-notch level to grow best quality plants. Their growth cycle, I think you mentioned this early, it lasts up to 90 days, and marijuana crops cannot be held too close together. Otherwise, the female plants can get pollinated. And, when it came to this, my mind, I had no idea of this. I had no idea when I started all this research a number of years ago that there was another plant out there that could provide all of the things that marijuana does without any of the negative side effects. Mm-hmm. Nobody talks about that. So I encourage everyone to research more about hemp versus marijuana. Because after reading through all of the information that I found, knowing that hemp is now legal to grow and harvest in the U.S., and the overall negative and or murky outcomes of either medical or recreational marijuana, I firmly believe that we must encourage the study of hemp and discourage medical marijuana.
All right, so now the CBD oil.
Yes.
That I see in all the fast food stores, in all the supermarkets around, mm-hmm. Is that okay for my patients to buy that?
Yeah, it's going to be from hemp, and it's going to be from hemp. So the stuff that you pick up, at the grocery store or in a pharmacy or anything
anywhere.
Really you can legally buy here in the United States where you're not having to go to a dispensary
to get it.
Some of that can vary from state to state, but yes.
My patients can try that for their aches and their pains,
yes,
and their headaches and their nausea, mm-hmm, and their migraines and whatever. They can experiment with it, and they,
yes,
don't need a doctor's prescription, and mm-hmm, it's perfectly safe.
One of the, and I meant to write her name down, but it was one of the doctors that I was reading, and her comments on this was that she, quote, always recommends her patients to start with hemp CBD. She said that should be everybody's starting place before they move to medical marijuana or something, because she said the vast majority of the time, their ailments are going to be treated with CBD from hemp, and they will not have to dabble with marijuana and run the risk of having a negative side effect from the THC.
It was interesting because since CBD can be purchased over the counter now in so many places in South Carolina, I have patients who come in who have chronic pain conditions. Mm-hmm. Not severe pain, but mild to moderate pain, who swear by their CBD mm-hmm. product that they purchase over the counter. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of different varieties, and I'm sure that it comes in various potencies depending on who's mm-hmm. producing it. And so they'll have their different supplier, their mm-hmm. different product that they use, and they'll swear by different products mm-hmm. that they've purchased at a different location. And they'll come in and they'll describe to me what they've been using and where they got it and how it's helped their achy, breaky joints. And right. they're just happy as a clam. Now, a lot of them are embarrassed to tell me that they're doing it because they think I will disapprove. Mm-hmm. But I tell them, I say, no, that CBD that you're getting is perfectly acceptable. It comes from a hemp plant, not from a marijuana plant. Mm-hmm. And my patients don't really understand the distinction. Mm-hmm. And I tell them it's perfectly fine for you to try that.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And we don't differentiate enough between, you know, people hear CBD, and you're right, they automatically think marijuana, not realizing that the better plant for CBD, which is what everybody says out there, is what you need for treating a lot of these ailments, a better source for that is hemp, and that a lot of these places that are selling it, all of them here in South Carolina, really, because it's still illegal here, is going to be coming from hemp. So answer me this, Dad. We have legal opioids that are highly addictive. Don't you think, as a medical doctor, that marijuana is a better alternative?
Well, here's the answer to that. Marijuana is not really a physically addicting drug. In other words, you won't develop a physical dependence, but there are psychological ramifications. What that means is your brain adjusts to it, requiring more and more until you become mentally or psychologically addicted. And it does, in fact, provide a high. There are no tremors or depression, nausea, anxiety, nightmares, things like that associated with the high that marijuana provides. Only about 9% of all marijuana users actually become addicted to the product. But 40% of everyday users become psychologically addicted, which generally incorporates those using it even for medical purposes.
Right. So what you're saying is, you know, most of the folks who are taking marijuana for pain are daily users. Would that be?
Well, if they get it from a medical provider, mm-hmm. then they're using it for medicinal purposes,
right.
which is legit. But even they're going to get attached to it.
Right. And this is saying that 40% of those who are using it daily, maybe to treat their headaches or their, you know, whatever it is that they've got going on, 40% of those folks are becoming addicted.
They are. They are exactly right. And if they're buying it on the street illegally,
right.
or if they're in a state where it's legal to get it for recreational use, and they're using it for some medical purpose, mm-hmm. if they use it every day, they're going to become psychologically addicted to that mm-hmm. marijuana. Now, let's talk about another thing. You know, we're talking about legal opioids and patients who get addicted mm-hmm. to legal opioids. There's a study done in the state of North Carolina recently. There are 2.2 million residents of North Carolina who take prescription opioids for chronic pain. In the year 2010, 478 narcotic-related fatalities were recorded among those 2.2 million patients mm-hmm. who took legitimate prescriptions of pain medications. And that amounted to a rate of 0.022%. Right? Mm-hmm. And folks worry all the time about patients mm-hmm. who take pain medications mm-hmm. for chronic pain. And when you look at a 0.022%, patients who are taking pain medication are not the ones who are dying mm-hmm. from opioid abuse. It's the folks who are buying their drugs on the street. They're not getting it from their doctor.
Which is why it's so frustrating for you doctors when you're trying to prescribe a patient who's looking you in the face and they're in so much pain and you know that you've got the government breathing down your neck saying not wanting you to prescribe pain medication because you know it's not your patients that are coming into you and sitting in your exam room who are abusing this medication. And so it puts you guys in this very frustrating situation.
They're saying that doctors are responsible for the opioid crisis.
Yes, they're trying to blame you guys.
Yeah, and we're not responsible. It's the people on the street who are buying and selling mm-hmm. drugs and mixing it with alcohol and Valium, and they're the ones who are dying. It's not my patients who have chronic mm-hmm. arthritis or chronic lumbar disc disease or mm-hmm. chronic rheumatoid arthritis. They're not the ones who are abusing their drugs. They won't give away their drugs. They're not going to sell their drugs. They're
That's
in
right.
chronic pain. And they won't do anything to part with their medications because mm-hmm. they need it for pain relief.
And you were telling me some numbers earlier about the number of Americans that are prescribed pain relief medication and the number of those who become addicted. What were those again?
Well, there are a large number of Americans who prescribe pain relief medications every year, and less than 7% actually become drug addicts. They become addicted to their pain medications.
So they're legally obtained.
To their legally obtained medication. Only 7% of prescription pain medication users become addicted, compared to 40% of daily marijuana users. Now, you got to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those folks are out there clamoring that we need to legalize marijuana mm-hmm. for all manner of pain relief. 40% of daily marijuana users become addicted, whereas only 7% of my patients mm-hmm. who take opioids for chronic pain end up addicted.
So
that's a huge disparity.
And trying to claim, and this is another one of their claims, is that medical marijuana is going to resolve the opioid crisis.
And that's not true at all.
Yes.
Not
true at all. And these numbers really put that in stark contrast.
Yeah. So listen, I believe seriously that CBD, the cannabinoid chemical devoid of the addictive mind-altering substances contained in THC, could be a better alternative to some opioids. But as evidenced by the North Carolina study, blaming prescription medicines for the opioid crisis is grossly misleading. And medical marijuana is not going to resolve the problem. It will only make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, for young people aged 12 to 17, they're 4 times more likely to abuse marijuana than a pain reliever. And going back to an earlier statistic, nearly 3/4, 73.5% of youth aged 10 to 17, they are in treatment for substance use. They report that marijuana was their primary substance of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, all right. This whole conversation was sparked because of South Carolina and the move. We're one of only 4 states that have marijuana totally illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making moves to legalize it. So let's talk about South Carolina and medical marijuana.
Well, I think passing legislation now is really kind of a debatable point, because there's so many new medications coming on the market in the near future that will be safer alternatives. And there's a lot of research that's going on.
Mm-hmm. And that's because the NIDA monopoly
right.
that you talked
that's
about that, earlier.
That's gone away.
And it's, they're now able to do a lot of this that we talked about it earlier. So they can now do this research that they need to do.
Yeah. You know, I think it's premature for us to be trying to push mm-hmm. through legalization at this time, because there'll be a lot more research available soon. There are a lot of medicines coming available now for treatment mm-hmm. of a lot of these ailments that folks are claiming that marijuana can treat. And let me finish the whole program by saying this. If you had any other drug on the market that was being made available in its rawest form, no clinical studies, no proven results, no reliable form of ingestion, no statistics regarding dosage, it was just simply a ground-up powder in a test tube, would you support the wholesale utilization of that drug? I don't think so. Not knowing how strong a dosage is going to be made available from week to week or day to day as you make that drug form available in a dispensary, and not knowing the best form for people to take in any particular usage, not knowing the quality of the dosage that people receive from day to day, I don't think that folks would approve that. That'd be foolishness. Mm-hmm. That's crazy talk.
Yeah.
You know? And I that's what people are mm-hmm. exactly what they are saying with marijuana use. Particularly when they legalize it and people right. are going to be able to grow it, crush it up into a powder, mm-hmm. and then take it for their own purposes in any strength, in any mm-hmm. form, in any amount. That is crazy talk, Anna.
Well, and we've talked about the medical benefits of hemp based on CBD. They far outweigh that found in marijuana, especially when the dangers of the THC in marijuana are considered or is considered. So to continue to push for legalization of medical marijuana in South Carolina, to me, seems to reveal that what we really want is marijuana legalized. Because, you know, as we've talked about, hemp CBD, which is fully legal in all 50 states, provides every benefit medical marijuana does other than pain related to muscle spasms. Ignoring hemp-derived CBD in favor of medical marijuana reveals we don't really care about the medicinal uses. We ultimately want recreational marijuana.
That's the end game. That has always been the end game. And so I hope this has been helpful to our listeners. I hope you will take this information and transmit it to your legislators. And I hope that everybody sees through what those who push marijuana are trying to achieve. They're trying to achieve, ultimately, recreational use of marijuana in every state. And that's a catastrophe. It's been a catastrophe in Colorado, which was one of the first states to legalize recreational marijuana. And we don't want that in South Carolina.
Well, and I think we're beginning to see the strong connections, as we talked about in the first, the part one of this series, the causal relationship between marijuana usage and schizophrenia and other psychoses. And there's just a lot of negatives that are associated with marijuana. And their eyes are being blinded to that. They're not being told the truth of those things. And that's why we decided to do this podcast, because we needed to talk about it.
The last thing I'll say is the interesting thing in my medical practice, it's not people who are highly educated, affluent, in positions of influence in my medical practice who are coming to my office and saying, Dr. Jackson, when are they going to approve legalized marijuana in South Carolina? You know who asked me that routinely in my medical mm-hmm. practice? It's low income, poorly educated people who are already addicted to multiple medications, mm-hmm. narcotics, cocaine, things like that. And they'll come into me and they'll say, repeatedly, Dr. Jackson, when are they going to legalize marijuana in South Carolina? These folks are already addicted to multiple mm-hmm. other drugs, and now they want recreational marijuana legalized in South Carolina. And that question is asked to me multiple mm-hmm. times every week. And these folks have massive problems in their lives. They're poverty-stricken. They don't have good jobs. A lot of times they're not employed at all. And now they want to add recreational marijuana to the list of chaos chaotic things in their life. And just the mere fact that that client, part of my clientele is the ones that are seeking to have recreational marijuana added to their list of problems tells me who is pushing for this in South Carolina.
Well, and mentioning South Carolina again, we didn't talk a whole lot about S-335 here in South Carolina and that bill. Of course, a lot of those who are conservative are saying it has so much teeth to it that it just restricts the industry totally. They'll barely be able to do anything, grow anything, sell anything, dispense anything, all of these things. So it's, you know, we're going to give them that, you know. And here's my question. This is what I want answered. If you are opposed to marijuana, medical marijuana, to such an extent that you would pass a bill, and I read through it today, that has so many limitations on it that it's going to be almost impossible to dispense or to get, then why are you passing it to begin with? I mean, why are we even crossing? Why are we even crossing that bridge? Because you're either opposed to it, or you're just like, well, you know, I mean, why do we have all of these exceptions? Why are we even allowing that camel to get their nose under the tent? Because as we saw with states that we talked about earlier, you know, they started out with decriminalizing and then boom, boom, boom. Every single year, the push just gets stronger and stronger and stronger until we now have quite a few states here in America that have totally legalized marijuana usage. And it's just the tip of the iceberg, and it will not stop here, because once you start cracking open that door, which is what this bill will do in the state of South Carolina, the marijuana industry will not stop until they have everything that they want. And so you know what? I talked about this in my podcast last weekend or a couple weeks ago. Stop at the word go. You stop them at the word go. Right here. This is our line in the sand. Right here, right now.
Thank you for listening to The Hannah Miller Show. Please remember to subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is produced by Bob Sloan Audio Productions. If you'd like to find out more about Hannah or to schedule her for a speaking event, go to her website, thehannahmillershow.com.